Good afternoon. My name is Frederica, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the May investment call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. If you should need assistance during the call, please press star, then zero, and an operator will come back online to assist you. Thank you. I would now like to turn the call over to our host, Ms. Terry Smith. You may begin your conference, ma'am.
Thank you very much. Yes, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining the call today for the Trust Company's quarterly investment call. My name is Terry Smith, and I work with the Naples Trust Company in Naples, Florida. As a reminder, information presented is for educational purposes only and does not intend to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities product, service, or investment strategy. Investments involve risk and are not guaranteed. Please consult your financial advisor, tax professional, or attorney before implementing any strategy or recommendation discussed during this call. And now I would like to welcome and introduce our two speakers this afternoon, Ian Bruch, who is our Chief Investment Officer, and Tim Vick, who is our Director of Research. They will be answering all of today's questions. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hi, Terry.
Hi, Terry.
All right, well, the first obvious question relates to market sentiment. It seems things changed overnight starting last October 1st. Ian, the questions relate to the market's recent volatility, with a lot of that volatility being attributed to trade and tariff issues. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think clearly, you know, the more recent market volatility is directly attributable to comments made, you know, not only by our administration, but then China's leadership in response, as well as the actual imposition of tariffs on China and then their own retaliatory tariffs that they just recently implemented. I also believe that we're probably going to experience additional volatility as the year progresses and those eventual negotiations continue to progress. But, you know, I think it's an important reminder that we're going to remain focused as an investment team on the actual impacts that, you know, those eventual real decisions may have. Until then, the conjecture, you know, will undoubtedly continue to create some volatility, but we're not going to overreact until some sort of agreement comes to fruition, and that, frankly, could take some time.
Okay, well, Tim, what do you think the market is fearing the most when it comes to trade issues with China?
Well, investment managers like us tend to try to connect the dots, and anytime we see a point of worry somewhere in the world, whether it's regarding a company or a sector or asset class or a country, we're trying to figure out what potentially could happen to Y and Z, and, you know, and what kind of fallout would occur. And the market right now is looking at the fact that the United States and China really are providing all the incremental GDP growth to the world economy at the moment, and combined they're about 40% of the world's economy. So if you get them in a trade tip that's prolonged and suddenly it helps slow down the growth rate of their economy, it has a larger impact on the world economy. And you throw in the fact that Europe may get itself entangled in some of these issues, and you're throwing in another 20% of world GDP, there's some potential larger implications that may, you know, filter in later this year in terms of slightly lower economic growth. But I would also point out that tariffs are a tax, and anytime you tax an activity, you're going to get less of it. So you put all those factors together, and it's throwing a little bit extra worry in investors' mind right now.
But, Tim, do you think tariffs really are going to have that big of an impact on the economy or the performance of U.S. companies, or is there just a lot of media hype baked into this?
At this point, I would say there's some media hype baked in. Companies experienced firsthand the shock and awe of tariffs last year, and I think they handled them pretty well. And I say this having listened to a lot of conference calls and listening to managements make their judgments and assessments as to how the tariffs are going to impact them. And they're doing a lot of defensive and even some offensive things to fly around those tariffs. They're passing costs on to their suppliers. They're raising prices when they can. I'm talking about U.S. companies. They're diversifying their supply chains. They're replacing suppliers. They've already taken and started to take steps last year in anticipation that we were going to have a prolonged, you know, tariff issue. Now, the tariffs that were recently passed by the Trump administration, which I think enacts 10 to 20% or 25% taxes on Chinese imports, and then China retaliated with 25% tariffs on a number of goods. In the larger scheme of things, if you fully impacted those and ran them through the economy for a year, it might impact corporate earnings to the effect of about 1.5% to maybe 2% on an annual basis. It's really going to be a smaller blip than what I think the market's fearing right now.
Ian, let's wrap up this conversation on trade tariffs in China. Can you give some examples of potential impacts on companies?
Yeah, sure. I think a few examples. You know, some capital-intensive businesses such as industrial or material companies that have large input costs tied to China could be more acutely affected by the tariffs. You know, in the news today is the news out of related to Huawei, the Chinese smartphone company, and them being blacklisted by our own administration. And that's going to have some impact on some companies here that sell to Huawei, particularly in the semiconductor space. But, you know, Tim alluded to it earlier in his comments. A lot of the talk around tariffs, I think, gets misconstrued. Companies like Walmart and other big consumer-related companies that source product from China, a lot of those costs are going to end up getting passed on to consumers. So the companies themselves, so the shareholder class that owns a lot of these great consumer companies that are sourcing things from China, should do just fine.
All right, let's turn to the market now, the stock market itself. And Ian, back in January, you were saying that the stock market would rise double digits in 2019, and so far you look spot on despite the recent market weaknesses. Are you still holding to these predictions? And if you are, what's driving this bullish outlook?
Well, yeah, no reason to change our outlook at this point. I think one of the reasons we thought we could see a double digit 2019 was because of how poor December of 2018 was, and we finished the year down about 5%. We thought much of the selling that transpired in December was completely overblown. Not that we were expecting a 15% rebound in the first 3 months of this year, but we did expect the market to gain some traction this year, and a double-digit return in 2019 seemed pretty reasonable on the back of what happened in December. You know, and what that says to us is we're sitting here in late May. We're up about 15% year-to-date through 2019. If the market goes no higher for the year, then we've had a pretty good year. So I continue to expect some volatility throughout the remainder of the year. We'll see where we go from here. But, yeah, no reason, either from an economic standpoint or in listening to our companies report their quarterly earnings announcements, do we think we need to revise our expectation for what the next 12 months or so holds.
All right. Well, Tim, do you really think the market can potentially rally even further this year?
Well, if you couple it with Ian's comments just now, that the rally so far this year was justified just to get back the decline in December, you can argue, and we've been arguing, the market's actually at fair value. Fair value doesn't mean that the market is at its peak. It just means that here on out, there really aren't excess returns you can get by investing at today's price levels, but it means that you're basically going to get appreciation relative or very, you know, equal to corporate earnings growth. And if corporate earnings can advance at 6 or 8% annualized rates over the next 12 months, I would expect 6 to 8% more appreciation out of this market just to keep the PE ratios of stocks constant. So, yes, you know, mathematically, you can make a very easy case that as long as companies keep growing from a fair value level, there's more appreciation to be had.
Ian, we're now just getting to the end of earnings season. What's your quick assessment as to how American corporations did?
Yeah, I think largely, I mean, I'll lump them all together. I think largely we've been pretty pleased with results. And frankly, that's been a sentiment of ours over the last several quarterly calls that we've done, because companies continue to post pretty solid results quarter in, quarter out. We had, I think, over 70% of our companies at least meet or exceed their expectations in this most recent quarter, so that's pretty strong. And I would also say that it's nice to see on the back of a lot of conjecture in late 2018 that we may be heading into a recession at some point this year. So companies are showing that they're continuing to generate positive sales growth and good earnings momentum. So I think, yeah, there's always exceptions, of course. Every quarter you have a few up as a basket of companies. We've been pretty pleased with the results.
Tim, I know as Director of Research that you're always poring over earnings reports. What were some of the trends you saw in this past quarter earning reports? Were there any examples for companies that stood out?
At this point, we've had probably 90 to 95% of S&P 500 companies report and 95% of our companies, and generally, we've been really pleased with what we've seen. The positive thing is about half of them have come through with revenue growth that exceeded our expectations and even the market's expectations. And as Ian said, 75% of them exceeded on the bottom line. So if you have that combination, that means companies are finding ways in the middle of their income statement through cost cutting and, you know, whatever form of financial engineering they're resorting to deliver better earnings growth than sales growth. And as long as they have that kind of operating leverage, we'd love to see that. Particularly, you couple that with an economy that can continue to grow at maybe 2-2.5%, that tells us there's still positive momentum for earnings growth going forward. We've seen a lot of good cost cutting or cost containment on part of companies. The other trend that I've seen is decelerating growth. We had very strong revenue and earnings growth out of companies in 2018, and it wasn't going to continue into this year. And we're seeing already companies that were used to getting 20 and 25% sales growth, that slowed down to maybe 18%. Companies that were getting 12% growth are now showing 8 to 10. Companies that were showing 2 and 3% revenue growth, like our large banks, are now showing a flatline revenue growth. And this is impacting companies across the board, even our fastest growing companies like MasterCard, Visa, PayPal, Fastenal. They're showing this decelerating revenues growth, which we expected as economies were slowing down toward the end of last year. When we see the second quarter earnings reports come out in July, I think we're going to see a little pickup again. But the trends, as I said and would summarize, were very positive for the next quarter.
But, Tim, can expense management only go so far? Don't we really need to see the revenue growth in these companies?
Ultimately, you do. You know, when you have revenue growth in a company, a lot of positive things naturally happen to a company's share price. And I'm saying this with 25 years' experience because I've seen 25 years of companies trying to manage their costs. When you don't have revenue growth, a lot of managements have to resort to unnatural things to prop up the share price, and we don't like to see that longer term. But the ability to cut costs even in the face of tariffs and such has been one of the remarkable stories of this market the last 20, 25 years, and I expect that companies still have the tools in their system to, you know, fly around whatever Washington or tariffs or inflation is going to throw at them.
What about then buying back stock as a way to enhance share price?
Well, it's been a really effective tool for more than a decade, and I think it started about a decade ago when the banks were really punished by the Federal Reserve and couldn't raise their dividends for several years. They resorted to buying back their stock in order to return money to shareholders. A lot of other industries picked up on this mantra, and now it's just a widespread phenomenon, and it's really been something that has accelerated and has been propping up earnings. The latest numbers I've seen is that corporate America is buying back about $70 billion worth of stock per month. So it's $840 billion on an annualized basis. That by itself is enough to add an extra 2 percentage points to earnings growth for corporate America. So if they naturally would have gotten 8% sales growth, they're going to get 10 because of all the share buybacks. And we have seen a number of companies in a lot of disparate industries, companies like Home Depot and Illinois Tool Works and Apple and Disney and McDonald's, they've all bought back 25 to 35% of their stock since 2012, and that's vaulted their earnings 30 to 45% higher than they would have been had they not bought back stock. So it's been a very positive trend, and as I said, it's accelerating. We're just going to be looking for signs that companies are doing very prudently.
Let's take a little sharper look at the market itself. Ian, can you talk about what sectors have outperformed and which have underperformed and your thoughts on why this is happening?
Sure. Yeah, I think just backing up, for the past several years, really the growth segment of the market has largely driven market returns. And with, you know, there are many types of growth companies, but more acutely, I think technology companies have really driven the market. And at the same time, dividend-paying or more value-oriented companies have largely underperformed. What we've noticed in the early part of 2019 is some of those dividend-paying value companies have actually been additive to performance for the first time in a while. These are great companies that we've owned in portfolios for a long period of time. That have continued to post good business results, but the stock prices have either languished or just not moved up commensurate with more growthy-oriented stocks. I think the reason behind why we've seen some resurgence in dividend payers this year is what's gone on with interest rates. We've seen a drop in interest rates, which makes those dividend payers that much more attractive on a relative basis.
You don't care to comment then on sectors?
Well, yeah, I mean, within growth, it's clearly technology that's driven the markets the past several years. That continues to be the case today. And then, you know, we've seen a nice resurgence in energy companies. That tends to be a little bit more on the value side of things within dividend payers. But that's trailed off a little bit. But they're always moving. We're always looking for new opportunities and spaces that are looking attractive. But you're right that it's not only companies that present opportunities sometimes. Sometimes it's the sector or the industry itself where they can fall on hard times, and then the valuation all of a sudden becomes really attractive. And we look for new ideas in those spaces as a result of that.
Has this caused you to make any asset allocation changes this year then?
No major asset allocation changes, and I think it's an important point. We do not make wholesale company-wide asset allocation decisions because we manage portfolios to the goals of the individual client relationship. And we say that a lot, but that is actually how we manage money. If we were making wholesale asset allocation changes based on market sentiment, then we couldn't also be tailoring these portfolios to the individual goals of the client. So these discussions, asset allocation discussions, happen individually, one-on-one, when we're meeting with our clients. And I think it's always appropriate to review it, to talk about it. Most often, those are the conversations that I'm having with my clients is, you know, how much should we have in stocks versus bonds versus cash at any one time? That's a decision more tied to your goals long-term. And so those asset allocations tend to be pretty sticky through time. We tend to not shift them around what's going on in the short term within different areas of the market.
Tim, let's go into a couple of asset classes that may contain a bit more risk, small cap companies and overseas companies. What are your thoughts on those two sectors?
Well, generally, if we're following a general diversification or risk reduction strategy, as Ian just pointed out, these are natural components to put in a portfolio. But we just don't blindly go into those asset classes just because my chart says we should. We like to make sure the fundamentals line up with what the client's objectives are going to be. If you look back over the last several years, you're going to see a preponderance of large cap U.S. companies. And we felt many years ago that that was the right place to be. And it's kind of borne out that large cap companies, whether they're paying dividends or just growing very quickly, had the ability to grow faster than many overseas markets. They had the ability to grow faster than a lot of small cap companies. We've been very pleasantly surprised to see companies as large as Microsoft and Facebook and Google growing faster than the average small cap company. And we felt that this was possible several years ago. And that's why we've had this, overload of large caps. It won't last forever. We think we've taken very good advantage of that type of trend. But longer term, yes, we're always looking at small cap companies. We're always looking overseas. We'll find ideas as they develop, and we'll put them into portfolios.
All right, Ian, let's switch gears again and look at the bond and fixed income part of the markets. I know we've all been enjoying money market rates in excess of 2% the past 6 to 8 months. Is this going to continue? What's going on with the Fed? What's going on with the interest rates?
Well, it's really been quite a sea change of the last 9 months or so within the bond market generally and interest rates. That really started in October of last year when the Fed raised, and then they raised again in December. We obviously had the market sell-off, but I think people are more aware of what's gone on with the stock market because that gets more widely reported. But the movement in the bond markets, yields have really fallen pretty considerably over the last 6 to 9 months across the board. So, it is nice that we're getting higher money market rates and short-term dollars. We're now earning more on that than we were certainly a year ago. But what's happened on the rest of the maturity yield curve is a lot of those yields have come lower. So that's really caused sort of a flattening in the yield curve. So, you know, if you own a bond portfolio, if you've been an owner of a bond portfolio, you're probably pretty pleased because as interest rates have fallen, the market value of those bonds has increased more recently. But in terms of our outlook for fixed income, so if you were to add bonds to a portfolio today, the outlook is worse today than it was 6 months ago because they're now yielding less than they were 6 months ago. So a buyer of a bond today is going to earn less than they would have if they had bought it 6 to 9 months ago. So interest rates have moved lower, and so our outlook for fixed income has been slightly more bearish as a result. We're still using fixed income primarily as a risk reduction tool more than anything. It's been hard to add bonds to a portfolio to be additive to total return. It's been primarily to keep people sleeping at night. We have many different risk tolerances at this company. There's nothing right or wrong about that, but bonds have really been used as a safe haven more than anything.
And there's been some talk, not so much maybe the past week, but about a flat yield curve, inverted yield curve. Can you talk a little bit about that this afternoon?
Yeah, so an inversion in the yield curve simply means that longer-term rates move lower than shorter-term rates, which is somewhat counterintuitive because as a bondholder, if you're going to lend money to a government or a corporation for a 10-year period of time, as an example, you should be compensated at a higher rate than if you're going to loan them money for, let's call it 3 to 6 months. That just makes good sense. But an inversion in the yield curve means that the market sort of prices those bonds lower. So we've noticed that 10-year bonds, and I'm speaking to the Treasury yield curve right now, that 10-year bonds are now sort of, depending on when you look at it, at par or right around where 3 to 6 month Treasury yields are. And we've seen an inversion in those two as well. Now, what that really means is the bond market is signaling that they're much more bearish. So, you know, we've seen throughout history that when we get an inverted yield curve, that can portend some sort of recession in the economy. But we've also had long periods of time where interest rates have remained sort of flat. We've had a flat yield curve, and we've had prosperous economy and good stock market returns. It is nonetheless something that we watch pretty closely. We see that as one of the biggest risks to the economy and the broader market is interest rate levels.
What's going to happen then to get long-term rates rising again?
Well, I think we're going to need just more good economic data points coming out. That yield curve will reinflate if we continue to get good positive GDP growth. And I think the Fed's going to continue to take a pause on further rate increases from here, so you won't have that upward pressure on short-term rates anytime in the next 12 months or so is my expectation.
All right. Thanks, Dan. Tim, the economy. Let's talk about that for a bit now. What economic signals have changed during the past 3 months?
Well, if you're going back the last 3 months, my short answer would be not much.
Okay.
And that's really the dilemma and the point of confusion a lot of investment managers have. Because as Ian was saying, when the yield curve inverted toward the end of the year and the stock market was falling off, I think both the bond and stock market were giving off signals that there was a 50 to 60% chance of a recession in the United States in 2019. At the same time, private economists were saying there was probably only a 10 to 12% chance. So there was that huge dichotomy. The data has, has verified that, you know, we're nowhere close to a recession right now. So hence that was the confusion. And what we've seen since is evidence that the economy is maybe reaccelerating. The economic data coming out of the United States has looked particularly better in March and April. Same thing for Europe. Asia and China looks like their data probably bottomed in January or February. So we might be on the cusp of another global synchronized economic recovery. And if that's the case, then all the bets made toward the end of 2018 have been thrown out the window.
What would you say, then, are the economy's strong points and weaknesses today?
Well, I think the strongest points are in the labor markets. The unemployment rate is at a 50-year low. Wage growth has been pretty steady and growing. We're seeing small business surveys indicating that business owners are very optimistic still as to what the prospects are going to be for the economy going forward. Inflation is very subdued. Capital expenditures from corporations is still picking up at a nice, healthy rate. Don't forget we got a government running trillion-dollar deficits right now. That's stimulative to the economy, however you want to look at it. And you couple that with the fact that banks have the strongest balance sheets I've seen in 25 years. They can make loans. They can rake in as much of the way deposits as they can, throw those loans into the economy, and they're seeing very negligible loan losses at this point. So there's really no red flags out of the banking system that says they're going to start contracting lending. Those are, in all, very strong economic data points. Now, it's not suggesting 4% GDP growth, but certainly can support 2.5%, maybe 3% GDP growth. And that's all the economy needs. That's all the stock market needs, you know, to give us some more upward momentum. Now, you ask about the weaknesses. I think they're few and far between. We have a couple industries that I think have gotten noticeably weaker, namely autos. We saw Ford today make an announcement about layoffs. That's coupled with three other manufacturers that combined are, I think, laying off 28 to 30,000 people here in the next year. We got the housing industry that has stalled a little bit. It's not contracting. It has stalled. But fortunately, housing and autos as a percentage of the economy really doesn't have the impact it did maybe 20 or 30 years ago.
Okay. Now, I know in the past you two have pretty much said that politics doesn't necessarily impact business. However, politically, things seem to be more charged than even 3 months ago. And now that there are more than 20 Democrats lining up to take a run against President Trump next year, I'm wondering what you think about their proposals and what investors should keep an eye on these Democratic platforms with regard to the economy.
Well,
Tim, do you want to tackle that one?
Well, I was hoping you'd give that to Ian, but I'll give a shot at it. You know, anytime you have 20 competitors in any field, whether it be business or politics, it just means that if you're aiming for shelf space and you're aiming for share of wallet and you're aiming for media airtime, your opinions and your pronouncements have to be more and more flamboyant. And I think that's what we've seen the more candidates who decide to run. I mean, we started 5-6 months ago with some folks proposing that we were going to have 70% top income tax rates. We've had proposals to roll back the estate tax exemptions that were passed in 2017. We now are seeing proposals for health care for all, which means raising taxes to fund these outlays. We're seeing proposals for free education, foreign loans. I saw one today. One of the candidates talked about spending $1 trillion to combat climate change. I mean, the proposals are getting a little more financially outrageous, if you allow me to use that term. The good thing is I think a lot of these are not going to see the light of day if we have divided government past 2020. Also, we got to understand the Democratic Party is going to eventually coalesce around a single candidate, and that candidate will have to pick and choose which proposal actually has marketability and which one can actually fly through Washington and just settle on that going through the election. And as I look at all these proposals, in essence, what they're trying to seek is another way to redistribute income and wealth around the economy. And to me, that's not something that generally helps grow an economy. You just can't move money from one pocket to another and say that that's going to be productive for economy. And I think if either party's candidates really want to help solve some of our intractable problems with government spending with our economy, you got to focus on growth. Growth takes care of a lot of things. If some of these proposals start refocusing energy on developing economic growth and lifting it even a half a percentage point per year, that does wonders for curing some of these issues that the Democrats are proposing right now. But as I said, some of these are not going to see the light of the day, and it's really hard to handicap them right now.
Ian, do you think the market is taking any of these proposals seriously? For example, it seems like healthcare is in the news a lot, and the healthcare stocks have really gone out of favor in the past few months.
Yeah, you know, the healthcare stocks in some ways have become a poster child for political discourse. You know, whether it's insurance companies like United Healthcare and others, you know, a major overhaul, for example, to our insurance businesses here in the States would obviously impact those companies. But the likelihood of major changes to where these companies are no longer going to be able to earn a profit seems rather unlikely. And, you know, the cynical part of me always likes to remind everyone that the lobbyists for these companies are pretty extensive. And so I think that's why a lot of times we don't see a lot of change to, frankly, some real problems within the system. And then in addition to the insurance companies, we spent a lot of time thinking about within the healthcare space, what do we want to own? There's a lot of great pharmaceutical companies. We're trying to look at companies that have more of an oncology bent, so drugs that treat cancer. There's real pricing power in that space relative to other areas. And then the medical device space as well. So hips, knees, shoulders, companies that produce products that help with those issues. There's been less news media and press around those areas of the market. So you can't just lump it all together and say, don't buy any healthcare companies. There's tremendous businesses within that space. Frankly, a lot of times we've seen great values in a lot of these companies because they've been beaten up on speculation, just tied to some of these ideas that, frankly, may never come to fruition. So we're happy to be buying these companies as long as we can have some rationale for what it holds for the next 3 to 5 years.
Well, how about we wrap up the call this afternoon with going over everybody's favorite topic, some specific companies. And, Ian, since you were just talking about the healthcare sector, Could you spend a couple of minutes talking about CVS, United Healthcare, and Allergan?
Yeah, sure. I'd lump CVS and Allergan into the same bucket in terms of two companies that have largely been completely unloved by the market. CVS, we started purchasing in most accounts probably in the $70 range. Now it's in the low $50 range. And we've had quite a few client questions about it, and they're reasonable questions. Anytime you buy a stock and it goes down a bit, it's rational to ask the question, do you still want to buy it? That's a question we ask every day that we come in. We've had many discussions about CVS as an example. We are currently happy to continue purchase CVS right now. We think it's a tremendous value. The stock has obviously gotten cheaper as we've been purchasing it, but as long as the story hasn't changed, it becomes more attractive on a going forward basis. So, we're long-term investors, clearly, and we're happy to continue to be buying CVS. United Healthcare is a newer idea we've been kicking around. It's an insurance company that's been largely beaten up, again, tied to some of the media speculation around changes to healthcare insurance here in this country. But it's a tremendous business, trading at a really attractive valuation right now.
Well, Ian, I just have to ask, with regard to CVS, how much time will go by before it starts to perform? And if it doesn't perform, what do you do?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a good question. We get that a lot from clients. And I would say we're always watching it. And every quarter we get sort of a new report card from the company. So as those report cards come out and we take a look at the earnings, we make an assessment every time. And then, periodically, intra-quarter, news is released on the company, and we have to decipher whether it's meaningful or not. And so we're constantly making that decision. So, we could decide in 2 weeks to sell the whole position, and we could be owners of it for the next 5 years. But we're not going to be moved by speculation. It's going to come through in the numbers, and we're going to make an assessment like we do with every other company related to what are the forward prospects of the company from a revenue and an earnings standpoint.
All right. Tim, let's move into industrials. Boeing has been in the news a lot the past mm-hmm. 3 months. What are your thoughts on that company?
Well, longer term, I think Boeing's going to do just fine. If we had to equate some of the issues right now, it goes back to like Bhopal, India, almost 25, 30 years ago, or the Exxon Valdez. It's that type of critical event that's going to, shake a company internally. Boeing has a lot of positives going forward in terms of its positioning and market competitive advantages in aerospace and commercial aviation. There's a lot of things it does that, frankly, nobody else in the world does better. Having said that, the issue with Boeing's stock is one of price more than anything else. Just before these incidents occurred, and they, as tragic as they are, the stock had hit what we thought was an egregious peak, and it was very overvalued. And the decline in price, I think it's about $90 now from the peak, only has brought it back to being overvalued rather than very overvalued. So Boeing, I think, its stock would have to just decline quite a bit more before we take a look at it. But, I will tell you, we have been looking at it just in the context of we know they're going to get through this issue. And it is a high-quality industrial company. We'd like to own it at the right price. And when we get a good handle is, what their prospects are going to be going forward.
Ian, the FANG stocks are always in the news, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. What are you all thinking about Facebook and Google these days?
Yeah, we still like both those companies very much. For years, Facebook and Google have been two of the largest and fastest-growing companies available to us, and they've also been trading at pretty realistic, reasonable valuations for the amount of growth that they produce year in, year out. So we continue to be happy to own those and buy those in client accounts, particularly for clients that are really wanting to grow their portfolio. Again, it's not a one-size-fits-all here, but generally speaking, yeah, if there's a growth orientation in any way to a client account, we feel like both those companies are good options.
And finally, Tim, the last question for you today will be about your favorite company, the one you follow passionately, Berkshire Hathaway. What are your thoughts on what happened at the annual meeting 2 weeks ago and Charlie Munger being 95 and Warren Buffett being 89? What's happening at Berkshire Hathaway?
Well, in retrospect, I think one of the greatest learning experiences of my career has been sitting down and listening to the last, 21 annual meetings. And part of the attractiveness is just listening to the perfectly logical, consistent way that Buffett has analyzed companies, the way he's talked about his Berkshire Hathaway, the way he talks about investing, about the economy and the government and how they all interplay with each other. And it's, as I said, it's been fantastically consistent. Had issues like Boeing or the ones facing Facebook or Wells Fargo happened 20 years ago, I am very confident that Buffett would have fielded questions on those and looked at those companies the same way 20 years ago as he is now. And that's a tremendous educational experience to carry through when you're investing clients' money. And I think we're all going to miss that insight, and unfortunately it's going to be sooner rather than later. And as we look at Berkshire going forward, we have to assume that this so-called Buffett premium is gone now. When I'm making an assessment of Berkshire Hathaway, I'm doing it with the understanding that and the assumption that Buffett's not there anymore. And can this company run itself? Is it still an industrial conglomerate worth owning? Can it still grow faster than the economy? Do the underlying diversified businesses still possess competitive advantages? Is it fairly priced? And can capital continue to be deployed in a way that keeps generating growth in earnings per share and book value? Right now, we still think yes. The verdict is out 2 years from now or 3 years out or whenever Warren has passed. But for now, Berkshire still is a stable core conglomerate for our portfolios, and nothing has really changed there.
And no doubt you'll be watching it very closely, Tim.
Every day.
Well, Tim and Ian, thank you so much for sharing all this information with us this afternoon. And those of you on the phone, thank you very much for dialing in. We hope you found this information helpful. And if you would like to discuss anything further or have any questions, please feel free to contact us directly. Thanks so much, everyone. Good afternoon.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.